Welcome to the very first episode of Booked Up with Jen Taub. I want to warn you, we're trying to do something a little bit different here. It's the opposite of an interview. It should feel like the conversation you have after all the guests have gone home and only your closest friends are still around. When you pour another glass of wine, plop down on the sofa, kick off your shoes, pull your hair back, and stab the bun with a pencil. I am that person who sits next to you, and we dive right in to find out how we're really doing, what's going on in our lives, and we're catching up because it's been a while. And the first person I'm sitting next to is my good friend, Dahlia Lithwick, who is going to talk with me about Supreme Court reform, her new book, Lady Justice, and why she spent a week wearing Axe body spray. Let's dive right in. Hey, good to see you.
Hi, Jen. How are you?
I'm good. Where are you right now?
I am in Toronto.
So are you back there for good or what?
We are here through June when my son will graduate high school. And then we are empty nesters and we'll probably like just live in a like surf hut somewhere.
A surf hut.
Probably not in Toronto.
Malibu or something like that?
I don't know. I want like, you know, those little cocktail umbrella drinks.
Oh my God.
I want some stopping
well,
to start.
The best cocktail umbrella drinks I've had, but maybe it was because it was my first post-COVID travel, was in Cayman. So if you're interested in both cocktails, beautiful beaches, and a tax haven,
I was going to say, and financial misconduct left and right.
I think it's unfair for you to call it misconduct if it's perfectly legal in that jurisdiction.
That's true.
May bring us to the topic of legitimacy of the legal system just like that. But so I just want to know, though, because your book, Lady Justice, came out at the end of September. It's been like, you're pointing at it, if we could only see. I have it right here. See? Look.
Okay. Listeners, there was pointing.
I'm wondering how the book tour has been for you. Any surprises along the way?
I mean, I think that it is fair to say that the days of the 9-city Barnes & Noble book tour are over, definitively. Probably pre-COVID were over. So the thing that used to be unrolled as a book tour, I think there's reason to believe that had stopped working even before people stopped going to bookstores. And I think one of the things that folks are trying to figure out now is what fills the vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what I was doing, which I love, is going to law schools and talking to law students and speaking to groups. And it was really fun, Jen. Like the best part, I will say, is the vindication of the midterms, because it would have been incredibly depressing to be flacking a book about women in power and democracy if the midterms had kind of proven that women just didn't care about Dobbs.
Yeah.
And that they, you know, had that like 2-week fuss about it, but had moved on to gas prices. And so the fact that none of that was true made it very, very fun to go around and talk to women's groups and to Planned Parenthood and groups who had been holding their breath, hoping that the midterms was not going to be a splat. And so I think it's very, very fun, deeply fun. You know this from your own book, to like be so in your head for such a long time.
Yes.
And think right until the last second, like, well, my dad will enjoy this, but like not really envision it being out in the world. And then, you know, I spoke at FAU in Florida, and like everybody in the audience like had a copy of the book. And then you're just like, oh my God, this is the best feeling in the world that it's out in the world. So that part, amazing.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like what? It's like you're talking about childbirth and skipping the part about, you know, labor and delivery. I mean, there was a lot more. I think there's a lot more anxiety and pain. I mean, I did fall in love with the topics I've written about, right? And you're in your own head and it's your playground. But what about the trauma and also the anxiety of seeing everyone carrying your book around? Like,
everything,
it's not like having
one
child. It's like all of a sudden it's like the Sorcerer's Apprentice. There's millions of them out there.
Everything you're saying. And also just to extend the childbirth analogy, Jen, I would say at no point did I fear that I was going to squeeze out a baby and some labor and delivery nurse was going to hold up and be like, God, this is ugly. Like, so it's the judgment, you know, that comes with a book that's really different from what comes when you're, you know, everybody gives you the benefit right. of the doubt when you birth babies. Here, you're sort of braced for some huge backlash, whatever it is. And that's very anxiety producing, you know, that someone's going to be mad or that you, you know, forgot to cite the right source. And I have to say there's been stunningly little of that. But you are right. It is so lonely to write. It is just fundamentally a practice. I used to say to people, like, I want to have written a book someday, but I don't want to write it. And that is completely true. Like the act of sitting for hours and hours and hours by yourself and getting edits back and then getting copy edits back and then getting fact checked. Like it's just, it's really, really hard. And then layered over that, I know you had this with Big Dirty Money, but like news is enveloping your book constantly.
Right.
And so you're trying to stay two steps ahead of a news cycle, you know, that keeps swamping the material you've done. And so I don't know how anyone in this moment writes a book without that sinking feeling that it is obsolete by the time it hits the printer.
And all this is to say, I would do it again a million times. I don't know about you. And actually, I think I found out, is this correct? I mean, I have always thought that Lady Justice was your first book, but I was just checking and I think you've written an earlier book. Is that right?
I have had two earlier books.
Well, this is like these marriages I didn't know about, and yes. I'm confused.
Yes, I am.
Why didn't you tell anyone this, Dahlia?
Well, one of them was written between college and law school. So that
wow.
was like old-timey. And that was wow. a wonderful book that I co-wrote. Little Brown published. It was called I Will Sing Life. And it was about Paul Newman's camp for kids with serious blood disorders and cancers. And I co-wrote it with the wonderful Larry Berger. And it was featured a bunch of kids from the camp and the poems they wrote. And so that was probably sort of a long time ago. And then just as I was giving birth to my first son, I wrote a humor book called Me Versus Everyone. with another amazing co-conspirator, Brant Goldstein. And that was a book of kind of tongue-in-cheek, humorous contracts for everyday occasions, like cleaning out the office fridge or breaking up with your hairdresser.
So you're not going to get away with this because you had a solo-authored book between college and law school. Like
co-authored book. That was co-authored
one.
With Larry. Yeah, both were co-authored.
Okay, got you. Yeah. Oh, so this was actually your debut.
This was my debut, okay. My Name Alone. And
well,
also the first pink one. Yeah.
I wasn't going to have anyone else's questions right away, but since we're talking a little bit about the writing process, Barb McQuaid, who you may know, former federal prosecutor, we all love her, also on Sisters in Law, produced by Politicon, who is producing this as we speak. Barb wants to know about your writing process and wants tips for going from shorter form articles to writing a longer form book. She's asking for a friend. No. as you know, she has a contract for a book. And, you know, I don't know if this is the place to give her that advice or whether you maybe want to just, I can give you her her phone number and you
yeah,
can
I did
give
that.
Her a
I
call.
Did that. I did that. Call me thing on Twitter. Call
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, but there are other writers who are listening to this, and since you're someone who is so well known for not just writing on a deadline, but writing so eloquently with humor about important topics, bringing yourself into these narratives, how did it compare for you, and what would you tell a writer like Barb?
Yeah, I mean, that is the question because I've had a 20-year career in which I often joke that I think in 1,200 word units. Like I mm-hmm. only know how to construct a 1,200 word argument. And I've been doing it so long. And I'm not joking when I say that. It almost unerringly happens that when I file a piece, I'll look at the word count and it's like somewhere between 1,150 and 1,300 because that's how I've learned to sort of manage my analysis. And so to go from that to writing these big, thick chapters was a huge pivot. And it's a pivot in terms of the time it takes and also kind of all of the mechanisms I usually use. Usually, you know, I'm writing on a deadline. There's a big, it's good enough vibe when you're trying to write to a news deadline.
The perfectionism can only go so far.
You can't. I mean,
right.
My husband, as you know, is an artist. And I often say if I wrote articles the way he made sculpture, like I'd still be writing my first piece, like moving a semicolon around. Just because
I bet
like,
he loved when you said that. It's a really loving thing.
Freaking encouraging. Hates when I say that. Yeah. So it's a good thing now I'm saying it on your podcast. But I just think that there is no perfectionism in journalism.
Yeah.
And I almost inevitably have to just stop at some point because there's an editor waiting. And that's not the case with the book. And also, I think, you know, just sort of the arc of the argument you want to make in a piece is really fundamentally different from the arc of a chapter in a book. And over and above that, and this really is sort of hashtag pro tip that I would give Barb and like earlier me, which is when you're writing a book, there's just an immense amount of interviewing, looking at transcripts, thinking, there's so much wasted work that isn't wasted, but as compared to the, what I think of as just clinical efficiency of journalism, 85% of the work I did for Lady Justice, I probably, you know, found on the cutting room floor at the end of the day. So that's really different.
So I'm going to ask you something that as a writer, having gone through this twice, I've tried to work out over the years, and I want to ask you more about the writing process. But the thing is, you talk about an immense amount of wasted or, you know, a lot of work, a lot of research, a lot of words that don't necessarily make it into the document. There's also a lot of things to remember across multiple chapters, avoiding repeating yourself, understanding not just each chapter standing alone and holding together as maybe 1,200 word units, but the whole thing telling a story over a longer period of reading time. And I've learned how to keep all of that in my head. I think it's kind of like orchestrating something, but was that hard for you at first to remember what you'd written and if you had written it and where it had been located as you were moving through this over the years?
I probably had less of it than you because the chapters for me chunked out pretty thematically. In other words, I sort of knew all along there was an abortion chapter, right? There's a, is this a protest or is this a riot chapter around Charlottesville? And I had made the decision early on that I also wanted to have enough doctrine in each chapter that, you know, you would sort of, okay, now I understand what the Skokie case was in Illinois and how that framed the debate about, you know, the rally, the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. So I wanted to have enough doctrine in there that people would feel comfortable moving through the narrative. But I think every chapter really did feel like it hived off a different chunk of law.
You make such a good point. Yeah, my first book I think was harder because I didn't do that. The second one I think I worked more thematically. So that's a bit of advice for Barb. Do you write by hand or do you do everything on the computer or both?
100% on the computer. How about you?
What do you mean by computer? I mean, I do everything all over the place. Like if you looked at my desk, you would see there's some post-its of things I remembered. I use my notes function on my phone when I'm in the world writing stuff down. Then I email myself my notes. The actual writing, I really do on the computer. But sometimes if I'm having a panic attack about not knowing how to begin a chapter, I do the old-fashioned way of taking out a legal pad. I also have spiral notebooks dedicated to each chapter and notes. And then, of course, transcripts from audio interviews. I mean, it's all over the place. But I think ultimately the writing itself is on the computer. How do you contain, like when you're walking around in the world and you're thinking of something, where do you put your notes?
Well, one thing to be sure is that the bulk of this book was written in COVID in my basement. I was one of those people who just did not move for a very, very long time. And so there was, to the extent
you wrote in a basement with no light?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm like the total troglodyte, bulgy-eyed basement liver now. Like it's
what kind of light did you have on, like a fluorescent or a desk lamp?
I mean, I had like a lamp and don't forget, I've also lived in like four rental spaces since I started this book. So there were different lamps in different rooms. But I think that...
So the one constant was a laptop. It didn't crap out on you at all?
One thing to know about me, and this is a sad comment on my life, is like literally as the Nazis were marching in Charlottesville in 2017, oh my God. Was in an empty house on the floor of my study. All the furniture had been moved, sitting and writing, you know, that day for Slate. And then like throughout my life, the laptop is the thing that, you know, comes with me. I pull it out. I file. In that sense, it's so portable. But I have utterly lost the ability to write on a yellow pad. I mean, my house is full of yellow pads with like shouty notes at my children. But like, I can't compose on a yellow pad. And one other thing that I will say, this is not for Barb, but for folks who are thinking about the problem you just raised, which is how do you start? Is I have absolutely learned from the best, Jack Schaefer, who writes for Politico now, when I first started out as a journalist, you start at the second paragraph. Like, you write your lead last. And if you're feeling stuck, it's for good reason. And so you kind of workshop what you're doing. But I am a huge believer in writing beginnings and endings at the end.
I think that's right. I have another theory too, which is it's really good to have a decent roadmap for where you're going and where things are going to go, because it's sort of tricks yourself into writing. But also, I sometimes think you write the part you're most passionate about when you're feeling it, and that might end up being a different chapter than the beginning. But if you have clarity around what you want to say, you should kind of just put it down.
Yes, and also I think here is where, and this is just not gratuitous sucking up, I have had both at Slate and at Penguin writing Lady Justice phenomenal editors. And I think it is a very, you know, having just said how solitary writing is, I think it is such a gift to have somebody Bigfoot into your copy and be like, no, this is actually dumb and wrong. You have to absolutely make space and have the humility to have a second pair of eyes. And especially with a book, where you're like, no, you don't understand. This is my fully realized dream. I put 3 years into this, and have them be like, yeah, nope.
Really good editors are good, because they can. What I wanted to say to compliment your book, which is what's very difficult, I think, moving from your typical 1,200 word pieces, is to maintain that kind of energy across a longer book, and you did that. And I don't know if part of the editing process helped you. I mean, I find that what I try to do is if something gets boring and I'm bored, I have to cut it out. I mean, so this gets me to another process question, which is, are you like a slow, meticulous writer, and then also in a quick editor? Are you more like write fast, edit slow, or do you not really have a method of attacking your work so that it keeps that lively voice, which you accomplished in the published book?
Thank you. I mean, again, it helps to have an editor. I'm a very fast writer. I think from years of 1,200 word, you know, regurgitated, 1,200 word, I think I've learned to just be an extremely fast writer. And I am a pretty decent self-editor, in part, again, tips, hashtag, but change your font, read it again in a different font. Unbelievably helpful. Read it out loud to yourself in funny accents sometimes. Really,
reading out loud is so important.
Yeah. I can do the trick now where I imagine somebody who absolutely is not interested in the material and read it through their eyes and imagine them being like, oh, this is super boring. So anything you can do, I think, that gives you a sense of looking at it for the first time, including, like I said, changing the font really does it. It's very weird. So I'm a fast writer and a fast editor. But I also, I think for purposes of the book, discovered myself to be a very slow marinator, which means that there were, you know, I decided to put Vanita Gupta's chapter, you know, from when she was at the leadership conference, I decided to put that at the very center of the book. I wanted that to be a sort of structural inflection point where you stop going from lawsuits to organize. So it took me a lot of moving things around and trying to figure out, this story begins on lawsuits, it ends on organizing. This story, you know, begins with Sally Yates, you know, multi-generation, very, very prestigious, privileged white lawyer, ends on Stacey Abrams, you know, who's African-American, also in Georgia, really learning the limits of just doing things in court. So all of those axes, mm-hmm. matrices that I couldn't, and it goes to your outline point a little bit, I couldn't have done in an outline because I didn't understand structure and arc for a big book. happened over a very long time. And I really, I think I said this to you before, but I had to rewrite big chunks of the book after Dobbs in just less than a week. And that really forced me to do some of that, what I would usually do as slow structural marinating very quickly. And that part was extremely hard for me because I never was quite sure I landed that plane.
You know, when you talk about Dobbs, and I think about, and you did land the plane, don't worry. But when you talk about Dobbs and you think, we talk about when the book comes out, you know, it comes out after the Supreme Court takes away, you know, our freedom to choose whatever was left of it. And then it comes out, and during the book tour, there is the, you know, the backlash through the midterms. And so there's like what's happening in the book, and then there's what's kind of happening in the world around it. And it occurred to me that, and other readers, that you made a decision to both tell stories about these incredible women you profiled and the context in which they lived their lives and current, and other than Pauli Murray, that's right now, but, you know, sort of their story. And you sort of put yourself into the book, right? But we don't get the backstory about you. And I realize I have known you for almost 6 years, and I kind of just met you in the middle of things. I was kind of thrown into a friendship with you as part of whatever you might call was the resistance. But there's so much I don't know. And I was thinking, you know, to me, this book is part of your process of better understanding your very personal, I would say, kind of, what would I say, love affair with the law. Similar to, you gave a talk recently or a few years ago called American Jews' Love Affair with the Law. But I think you have had a love affair with the law. And I thought, started like, you know, free associate and start thinking about love affairs. And I thought about the movie, The Way We Were. I hope you've seen this with Barbara Streisand and Robert Redford.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's sort of a Jewish woman's rite of passage.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
That movie.
Because we all end up with Robert Redford in the end. Yeah.
And I was wondering, if we were filming a biopic, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, of your life, I was like wondering, you know, would I begin it with that talk? And then would I jump to the Kavanaugh nomination hearings as this kind of breaking point, this inflection when you kind of had a break with the court? And then I flash back to the beginning, but I didn't know, where's the beginning? Like, the thing I don't know about you, like I know, you know, that Ruth Bader Ginsburg called your writing spicy, or that you were spicy. And I know about Chaos Muppets and I, you know, and things like that. And I know about your genius and what you've done recently. But I don't know why in the world you fell in love with American law. And I also don't know who would play you in the movie. You know, so can you help me out? Like, how did you get into this? And are you still in it? In all of this, and I guess there's even more, because I'm also thinking I might be wrong and thinking you've had your eyes are open or you had a break with the law. But anyway, so am I telling this right, that you've been transformed by the writing of this book, but where were you before?
There's so much there. That's the kind of question only Stephen Breyer gets away with asking. Seven-part question.
Well, pick any part.
No, you would just watch people just like melt into a puddle trying to figure out how they were going to attack a Breyer hypo. I mean, I think it is certainly true that, you know, I once had an editor at Slate say, like, disparagingly, like, you write about the Constitution like a day school girl, like a Jewish day school girl writes about the Bible. Like, there's so much weird reverence there. And I think, you know, I for sure had the experience in law school of reading, you know, the perfect Brennan opinion, or reading, you know, the line.
What is a perfect Brennan opinion?
I don't know. I mean, I just remember, you know, you'd read like Cooper versus Aaron and you'd get chills. Like, you'd read, I read Brown v. Board and got chills, and that's not
I get chills from reading Shakespeare, but you get chills. That's so interesting.
No,
it's the
I
same
really
for you.
I really did. I remember staying up late one night as a 1L and writing to one of my mentors in college, the great legendary Maynard Mack, who was one of the English, like before our generation, the generation before, and just saying, like, this stuff is literature, it's poetry. And I think he probably wrote back, like, go to bed, Dahlia, you're drunk. But I mean, I really was so moved by, you know, the promise and the possibility. And I think, you know, what you're describing, which is this journey, which for me actually doesn't start with Kavanaugh, probably starts with Merrick Garland being blocked and realizing that the court is now going to be a court in which one of the seats, in my view, is wholly illegitimate. And there's no language for that. And then that's doubled down with Kavanaugh, which, you know, we can talk about, which is in the book. And I think that there was this growing sense that what do you do when you're sort of worshiping at this temple that whether you agree or not with Bush v. Gore, whether you agree or not with Shelby.
To be clear,
you know, with Shelby County, at least you feel like there are nine people legitimately there operating more or less in good faith. And something really
Wait. And you thought that. You've thought that.
I mean, because I think that the court that I have covered for the last 4 years is fundamentally, absolutely different from the court that I covered through all the years, including with Clarence Thomas on it. But let's be clear, I came to covering the Supreme Court after Clarence Thomas was seated. So that had I sat through the Anita Hill hearings as a journalist, I may well have had the feeling I had when I sat through the Brett Kavanaugh hearings as a journalist.
So what you're saying, what up until this moment with Garland, even if you did not like the reasoning or the judicial philosophy or the outcomes of the decisions, you thought at least the people who were sitting in the chairs, who were given the authority under the constitutional process, were legitimately there. That's what you
I thought they believed. Were legitimately there, and even if, again, in the face of Bush v. Gore, which was improperly before the court, which was decided on a bogus theory, which was indefensible, and then which was inflected with, you know, all sorts of mayhem around Justice O'Connor and other justices who had vested interests, I didn't think that the court was systematically seeking to dismantle the institutions of American democracy until very recently. So maybe that's me being delusional.
No. I'm curious. No, I want to hear that. And when is the moment? I mean, you talk about the blocking by Mitch McConnell of Obama's ability to appoint Merrick Garland to the seat. So that's sort of like, okay, that's the first moment. But when was the moment when you thought it was the court was seeking to undermine the institutions of democracy? Like, when is that moment?
I think for me, the past 2-3 terms, when it's been clear that precedent has no meaning, that originalism has no meaning, that there are no breaks whatsoever, that this is a court that methodically reaches out and takes cases that are not before it, not properly before it,
right,
in order to dismantle pre-existing ideas of democracy, I think that's pretty new. And even though, I thought the reasoning in Shelby was bogus, I think, you know, the reasoning throughout my career has been bad, but I didn't actually think there was a supermajority on the court that was hell-bent on undoing, you know, decades of progress and would do anything to achieve that. And just to be clear, I mean, this is a really complicated conversation. This is the place where, you know, Justice Alito starts snarking and saying that's because you just don't like the outcomes. And it's not the outcomes. It's the shadow docket. It's the, you know, unsigned, crappy middle of the night orders that then are held out as doctrine. It's the systematic constricting of the vote. So that when Alito says in Dobbs, you know, if you don't like it, just get out there and vote. But he's actually in a project to make it harder and harder to vote, whether it's by partisan gerrymandering or racial gerrymandering or vote suppression. So I guess I just think there is an element of not just bad faith, but distorting the process to get outcomes that is new to me descriptively. And maybe that just means I was delusional.
Well, I feel like, you know, I don't need to give you a confidence booster, but like you were not being, I don't think you were delusional at all. I mean, maybe I have thought that the court's decision-making and the selection process, because it goes through the political system, was always at the very least political. And because it's based on party affiliation, who you appoint, partisan. But I agree with you that something has changed where it's kind of like, you know, they're now speeding up their activity in order to do what I think are taking actions that I think strain the court's legitimacy, which kind of gets me to this, the chief judge of the 11th Circuit. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about why you and L.A. Ms. Stahl and others were being publicly mocked. Does that mean you're doing the right thing? I mean, how did you find out about that? Can you tell us a little bit about what went down there?
Yeah, so this was at the big Federalist Society gathering in D.C. a couple weeks ago at the Mayflower, the August Hotel.
Oh, gosh.
And, you know, packed to the rafters with Federalist Society students, first and foremost. But, you know, four justices, I think, showed up to get standing ovations that evening. And yes, Chief Judge of the 11th Circuit, Judge Pryor, thought he would, like, test out his comedy stylings that morning at the plenary speech. And as you know, like, name-checked a bunch of people, including Ellie, including my colleague Mark Stern, including Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Rick Hassan, just, you know, and myself by name. I found out the way one usually finds out when people started saying on Twitter, like, just FYI, you know, this happened. I will say I interviewed Senator Whitehouse about it last week, not about that because we don't care, but I did interview him about something that was materially important, which is, you know, a years-long campaign for wealthy donors to get access and influence
right.
to Supreme Court justices, which does matter to me.
Through the Supreme Court Historical Society.
Among
right?
other things, you know, just write a check to the Historical Society and you too can become friends with and go on junkets with and fly justices out to your ranch to shoot. So that actually does matter. But I asked Senator Whitehouse what he thought about being name-checked. And, you know, in addition to the wildly improper behavior, partisan political behavior of a life-tenured Article III judge talking about politics from the dais at FedSoc. What Senator Whitehouse said that was of utility is, well, you know, that means you're in his head, right? And so I think, you know, I have lifetime tenure in the head of Judge Pryor. But I do think, and this is a serious point, and I will make it with seriousness and not flippancy, I don't think that the FedSoc people who joyfully accept, you know, when Jeff Toobin writes a piece about Leonard Leo as a kingmaker, right? And how great it is that FedSoc has seated every current justice on the court and that they have a vetting system to get rid of the Harriet Meyers and that they are, you know, literally bringing up law school students in order to seat them someday on the courts, that piece is okay in the hands of Jeff Toobin when it's written to say what outsized power Leonard Leo has. But that when Rick Hassan and I write that piece in Slate, somehow it's untruthful or unseemly. So as I said on someone else's podcast, like you cannot both suck and blow about FedSoc. It's either a benign debate society that does nothing partisan or political and had no role in seating Trump judges, or you take your bow, you say, yeah, we bought and sold the courts. We just got this $3.6 billion donation from one donor to pack the courts. And by the way, the state Supreme Courts, we win. But you actually don't get to be mad at people for saying publicly the same thing that you're saying at your events. And so I think it's really of a piece with Justice Alito, who took a brickbat to reporters last year and name-checked again reporters who were talking about the shadow docket. Instead of going after reporters from your lifetime tenured perch in the courts, maybe don't act like a political hack. Like, there's a fix to this. It's modulating your behavior to accord with, by the way, ethics canons.
See, Supreme Court justices are kind of like billionaires. People usually suck up to them because they want something. And this includes, and suck up maybe is the too root of a term because it's more systematic than that. You know, law professors wanting to never be too critical of the court because if they are, they know that they can't get their students placed in clerkships. And their own prestige, for whatever that's worth in their institution, is working inside of these institutions and getting power. And less cynically, you can't change the system unless you do what, I mean, if the Federalist Society gets it, if they want to have conservative clerks and conservative justices, they need to guide them. And so I can't blame liberal law professors for wanting to play the game to some degree. But at this point, everyone can see what a disaster the court is. And I and many of our listeners want to know, what's your solution? And maybe to say it in a more concrete way, if tomorrow morning you found yourself not in Canada, but actually in Washington, D.C., in the West Wing, in one of those sort of rabbit warren offices just below, not that I know what it looks like. Anyway, if you found yourself in the West
Wing. In a different basement, yeah.
In a different basement, and you had a meeting with President Biden, and he said, Dahlia Lithwick, what should I do?
I mean, I think that I've been pretty clear in the last couple of years that structural court reform is essential, and that it's essential. And this is rooted in conversations you and I have been having about institutions, you know, that institutions are not ends in themselves, right? Institutions are only useful to the extent that they work. And that once public trust in an institution, particularly an institution that has no power beyond public legitimacy, once that public trust is gone, you can't get it back, right? This was Justice Breyer. He used to always argue this. So I think that there is a moment at which you say public trust in the institution is gone. And this is the paradox. I know we've talked about this too. Having no institutions is much more dangerous, right? This is a theme that runs through Lady Justice, which is, you know, it sucks and it's broken and there's no plan B. Like plan B is fighting in the streets and we need the rule of law.
Dahlia, I don't mean to be this way, but you say these words structural reform and like that's code for something, but everyone has a different idea of structural reform. Are you talking about more justices?
Yes, I mean,
give me your list.
I mean, I think that if you look at the work that Biden's little blue ribbon panel, I shouldn't say little, Biden's
giant cast of thousands
cast of thousands that spent a very long time talking about structural reform. Everybody was obsessed with court packing. There were other things. There was transparency. There were ethics rules. There was talk about jurisdiction stripping. There was talk about term limits. So there's like a million things. And my view is, and this is entirely a failure of the media, which was like thumbs up or down on court packing. That was the totality of the conversation around what the work was that they produced. And I think the answer is do all of it. Certainly do some of it. Certainly don't wait for another 5 years while one or two bills linger on the floor, right? I think that the fact that we haven't been talking about this for 5 years is shame on us. And so do I have a favorite? Yeah, I think we should add seats. I think we should do, you know, some version of every president gets two picks. Like this is all easily fixable. But the idea that we're like afraid to touch this, much less talk about touching this, just strikes me as the most galactic self-own of our time. Because the idea that, well, but then they'll do it to us. They've done it to us. It's done. You know, the idea that they're not going to play hardball when they get control of the courts is insane. So my view is, and by the way, I think the clock has now run on this, but the idea that we can just keep hoping that, you know, Sam Alito is going to wake up tomorrow and be in good faith again is not a plan.
Okay, so that's nice, and so you're gonna but if you have to, but you so you're if you're saying all of the above, if you wrote the top of your list, I mean, I know all of this requires having a Congress, you know, who's willing to do it, but you know, and this is the sort of kind of a lame duck, but part of it, I think, it sounds like educating members of Congress And would they be even amenable to do any kind of jurisdiction stripping, saying, you know, limiting the court's, you know, judicial review to, I don't know. I don't know how what that looks like what's in, what's out.
I mean, I think on the fundamentals, I would say that this is, again, a flaw of that myopic view that not just in the halls of Congress, but I think around the country, that it has ever been thus, right? That there's always been 9 people on the court, not true. That no one's ever added seats, not true. That FDR's right. court packing plan was an unmitigated disaster, not true.
Oh, that's so important. That is like listening to the hearings on this topic. Can you go back to this? Because everyone says, you know, FDR failed when he attempted to pack the courts. Can you actually explain to me what he actually said, but what he did and why it was maybe a success, not a failure?
I mean, I think that historians bicker about the causality here, but I don't think there's any doubt that even though FDR did not manage to add seats to the court, what he achieved is what the historians have come to call the switch in time that saved 9, which meant that conservative justices retired, others flipped their votes and started approving New Deal legislation that they had been blocking. And at the end of the day, if you stand up to the court and you say this is not an idle threat, you may in fact achieve outcomes, structural outcomes, that you were going to do with court packing. So I just think we tell this deeply stupid story about FDR almost jeopardizing the strongest presidency in history, when in fact it's possible that he faced down the court and that they modulated their conduct as a result. So I just think if I have a theory of the case of why it was that at this time last year, just as it was becoming clear that President Biden had no interest in structural court reform and that had put together a commission that was going to kick the can down the road, that the court just took their foot off the brake and went over the cliff on absolutely everything.
Right.
It's because, with all due respect, I think that the president gave them license to do that. And so if you take away this existential threat and you say, no, I'm not interested in that, you are giving, I think, carte blanche to the court to behave as badly as it wants. This is unfalsifiable. There's no way that this can be proven or disproven. But it seems to me that last fall, in the wake of SB 8 and the court, you know, making clear they were going to let Texas nullify Roe on the shadow docket in the middle of the night, might have been a good time to not say, oh, we're not interested in that.
I want to go back to something you described as when I think you fell in love with the law. You said it, you know, when you were in law school, you reached out by late night email to an English literature professor about how gorgeous some of these decisions that you were reading were. And I was also an English major at the same college, though I leaned heavily into literary theory and deconstruction, which maybe explains why I would read the judicial decisions and question the narrative closure, which interfere with my ability to find the holding of the case. But that's a whole other story. But this love for the power and the grace of language and text is important in the fact that case law isn't just a story or a poem, but it's what we would have called in literary criticism, performative utterances, right? These words have actual power in the world. And I can see why you would gravitate toward that. And so we've talked about your writing, we've talked about your kind of reading of the court in the current situation, but I've never asked you really what you read for fun, not for research. Do you have time to read for fun besides doom scrolling or, you know, reading columns that other friends have written and sent along to you? Or when you did love to read as a child, what did you read?
I mean, as a child, I read everything. I was one of those.
What do you mean everything? Like, what was your first book?
I read my first book. I mean, I read all the Nancy Drew books. I read those All of a Kind family books. Do you remember
The All of a Kind family? I love them. Did you read A Tree Grows in Brooklyn?
I did. I mean,
Bette Smith. Can I just tell you something about that book?
Interview, not mine. No, it's yours.
So
I'm gonna just
to me.
Open.
Is that you're cracking
I
open a Coke?
Open my bubbly. It's not a beer.
So Do you remember in Bette Smith's A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, how they would like sell scrap metal to collect pennies? And the reason why they collected pennies is because they would pay this guy. He had a, I don't know if it was a booth at a fair, but there was somebody who had some sort of booth. And the kids would see these strings, let's say, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 strings, and you could pay a penny to pull a string. And if you pull a string at the other end, there might be a piece of candy. But what she really wanted, I think, was a pair of roller skates. I might be remembering this right. And she didn't never knew which one. You know, the representation was that if you pull the string, that there you would, one of them you could pull and you would get your roller skates. And so one day, I think she got enough money. She decided, you know, I'm going to get a whole quarter. I don't know how she got it. So she could pay for all of them. And it turned out there were no roller skates.
Womp womp.
Womp womp. And I don't know. I mean, I think to me that had a big impact on, I don't know, is that a metaphor for, the court, for capitalism?
I was going to say, it's the pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. It is certainly a metaphor for the arc you're tracing of how I, you know, have really come to doubt some of my fidelity to the institution.
But the difference is it's the only game in town. You know, right. We don't have to go give a penny to the guy that, you know, the con artist shyster on a street corner. I mean, the court actually matters and affects our daily lives. I mean, I think.
No, and that's kind of my there's no plan B. You know, if you don't believe in the court, we will be fighting out the 2024 election on the streets. I deeply believe that. Not that I like what the court's going to do, but I think we should be realistic. And I think it's also, it's funny because one of the sort of conversations I've been in a lot around the book is, well, but where do you come down on this, Dahlia? Like,
yeah,
do you
yeah.
believe or do you not believe? Like, give us a, you know, Dorsey-esque yes or no on Oz answer. And my answer is, like, I interviewed a bunch of women who come down in really different places.
Yes.
And, you know, I love Becca Heller, who just says in her chapter, you know, law is bullshit, and I'm using the master's tools to take down the master's house. Straight up. And then, you know, Anita Hill, who's like, without law, we have nothing but chaos, and I can't live in chaos.
Right.
So I don't know where I come
from. So I want to tell you, I actually come down closer to that side of things. Without law, we have chaos.
Well, that's, I think, where I am.
And that's, you know, even if it's imperfect, it's kind of like democracy. Democracy is an ideal. You know, it's something we approach. We've never fully had it here. But if you just say, well, because we haven't been able to achieve it, we should just give it up. That's sort of like giving up medicine because people still get sick. I mean, what does that look like?
Well, do you know the famous Justice Scalia story? He always told this story about originalism, and it's the story of the two guys, and they have to, you know, outrun the bear.
I don't know this story.
There's no way to possibly do this justice. But Justice Scalia, the whole point is like these two guys and they're out camping and they're being chased by a bear. And like, you know, they start to run and one guy says to the other, we're never going to outrun a bear. And the first guy says, but I only have to outrun you. And like that was right. And please don't send angry letters saying I mangled that joke because I must have heard Justice Scalia tell it 15 times. But the point is, you know, like what he applied to originalism, like, I think we just like we have to outrun like what's happening to women on the streets in Iran, right? That's much worse. And so I will take law with all of its flaws, because at least women have access to the levers of power that, like, you know, we don't actually have to be beaten on the streets. And so I think that's a lot. And to say like it's imperfect, it's born of like violence towards women and minorities. Yes, it is all those things. It was built to be such. And also it has achieved great good things, right? This is Vanita Gupta's, like, it did give us Brown. It did give us Obergefell. So my own view of the thing is we can have, you know, deeply ambivalent feelings about the fact that the law is both the instrument of freedom and democracy and all that is good. And right now, if you're a woman in Texas, the instrument of your oppression and suffering. That's just true.
And I think this is where the 2022, our recent midterms, say that the public agrees with us. The court went too far, and I don't care, you know, how many intelligent, you know, male commentators said, oh, you know, everyone's, you know, no one's talking about Dobbs anymore. We've forgotten. It's like, we all still have uteruses. You know, it doesn't go away if we're not talking about it. I mean, women in our lives, if you walked around every single day complaining about the injustice that wasn't solved, you wouldn't get out of bed. We waited and we plotted and we voted. Before we go, I want to make sure I say the names of the women in your book that you profiled and ask you a couple questions about them. Pauli Murray, Sally Yates, Becca Heller, Robbie Kaplan, Bridget Amiri, Vinita Gupta, the various Kaczynski accusers, including Leah Lippman, Christine Blasey Ford, Anita Hill, Stacey Abrams, and Nina Perales. All of them are worthy of profiling, and so many more. And I'm curious, I know how you chose them, but isn't it hard to leave people out? And even these women, you know, who's to say they'll be remembered? I mean, you have this line, you were interviewed the other day by Amy Goodman, I think, and you talked about how there should have been hundreds of Sally Yates. And you talked about something about how there's this sort of disjuncture between who gets famous and who gets credit. And I'd rather have people be effective, but I'm also pretty angry about the way history is told. And here you are trying to bring forward Pauli Murray's story, who many people knew who she was, but we didn't, being, you know, white women in the world that we were occupied. How is it we didn't know about her? Now she has a residential college named after her at Yale. Do we need to name buildings and create statues for people in order that young women in the future know that they can work hard to make a difference? I mean, I guess what I'm saying is your book gave me incredible hope, but also I felt a little bit hopeless because this is amazing. Instant bestseller, resonates with people. We get to hear these different viewpoints about law and the courts. Women plus law is magic is what you say. And yet 50 years from now, is someone going to discover, or 100 years from now, discover Dahlia Lithwick and say, oh, turns out she was a good writer? I mean, why do women get forgotten over and over again, given how we tend to be recently the only ones who are willing to stand up to power? Or is that why?
Oh my God, that's another.
Oh my God, it's a fucking multi-part question. God damn it. I'm sorry, Dahlia.
I feel like you have attended the Stephen Breyer School of Podcast Hosting.
Okay, damn it. Okay.
I mean,
but Dahlia, you're making me feel so insecure because this is what it is. This whole time we've been talking, I have been terrified that my podcast is going to be a failure. And so every time you criticize me about my long questions, I think, you see, I shouldn't have a podcast.
No, but you have.
Should I quit?
You have heard me on Amicus. My singular talent on Amicus is asking four-part questions. And then flummoxed people who just came on my show as a courtesy are like, I'm going to answer part two. Also, you're an idiot. Like, that is my brand. So, like, I would just say,
I don't want to steal your brand. I'll come up with my own.
Welcome to the club. I just think it's like a function of these are such big, intractable, and abstract questions that they often like just get padded on. If it makes you feel any better, I swear on this week's Amicus Plus, I asked Mark a four-part question and he only really barely got through the first. This happens. I think I want to answer your really thoughtful, soulful, brilliant question that single-handedly entitles you to have a podcast. And also, oh my God, you so deserve a podcast and I'm so happy to be here. But I
haven't been canceled yet, so that's good.
That's good. I mean, this is where I just have to parenthetically say that I always tell young women lawyers, I'm sure I've told you this too, I always say, you are someday going to be sitting at a table and they're going to be assigning cases and they're going to say there's a case about maritime law and you are going to be the person who like has a degree from Oxford on maritime law and you're going to say, maybe I don't know this well enough, and there's going to be a white guy sitting next to you who's eating a tuna sandwich and he's like, I'm eating a tuna sandwich. I am an expert on maritime law, and he will wave his hand and get the case. So like, dude, you deserve a podcast. End of story. Be the tuna sandwich you want to see in the world. Second, what was the second thing? Oh, this meditation on like fame and celebrity and who gets famous. Look, this is the hardest thing. And it is the hardest thing. And you and I have like grown up in the shadow of the RBG cult, right? Like that there is a story we have been telling for at least 15 years that says that one person single-handedly did everything all alone. And if we just get the like throw pillow and the mug, we too are part of that project, right? And that's...
There's a throw pillow?
Look, can you see? Hold on.
Oh my gosh.
Can you see it?
Okay. Nice. I have the earrings and the mug.
I'm just saying that we...
Okay, continue. That wasn't the point. I know.
We fold in, like, celebrity and consumerism and influencing. And, like, RBG was the first person who would always say, I stand on the shoulders of giants. Always name check Pauli Murray. Every time I ever talked to her, she would name check the people who came before. So I think as you and I are sitting in this, like, can I say the word shit show? That is produced by Elon Musk and the cult of fame and celebrity and money. And, you know, the shit show that is Donald Trump and the cult of fame and celebrity and money. I think we just have to keep counter-programming it with stories about people who maybe aren't billionaires and who don't think they can single-handedly fix the world, but who have sort of toiled in the vineyards for decades in obscurity and made change. And I guess what I'm saying is, and this is in no way to cast aspersions on RBG, who did change the world, but my point is that so did Pauli Murray. And yes. So this kind of crapshoot of who becomes famous and who gets on the court and who has law libraries named after them and who has tote bags, it's freighted up with race, right? As we know for sure. Yeah. It's freighted up with gender identity, as we know for sure. It's also just freighted up with freaking luck. And so what I wanted to do is surface the stories of people who didn't care that they weren't going to get famous because they just did the right thing, on the theory that I think for every 2L who is looking around saying, you know, how do I make a difference? Is it getting famous and like buying Twitter, or is it just like digging down and doing justice work? I want them to see a pathway to that second thing.
Well, toward that goal, and as we wrap things up, I wanted to surprise you with something, Dahlia, which is next semester, I teach a class, second time I'm teaching it, that I designed called Money, Law, and Power. And we read four books. One of the books we're reading next semester is Lady Justice.
That makes me so happy.
And while I have you kind of on the spot, would you mind zooming in to the class? No, I'm kidding. No, you don't. No,
oh, fine. For you?
You don't have to.
For you, my sister? Yes. And I will not, I will mock neither your four-point hypotheticals nor my husband's artistic perfectionism at that time.
Can I ask you one last thing?
Of course.
So I know this is going to make me fail the Bechdel test, but I have known you for nearly 6 years, and I have no idea how you met your husband. We don't talk about dating and stuff. I mean, we're supposed to be close friends, but we don't do that. I mean, not that you're dating. Gosh, Erin, she's not dating.
I learned a lot about you at that dinner, I will say, a few weeks
what?
In New York with Danielle and with the Avengers. I learned many things about you that we can discuss in your class after this podcast.
Oh, boy.
All good.
That was fun.
All good.
How did you meet, Erin?
Listeners, you need to know that Jen Taub couldn't get the drink she wanted at the restaurant we were sitting at, and so she went to the bar next door and procured a drink and brought it to the table. That is the kind of badass person.
I don't like wine. I am not a wine mom. I had had, I just need to give some context, Dahlia. You know... You're belittling me, darling.
That was so cool.
No. But what happened is I had given a talk at NYU about a paper I'd written about tax. See, this comes full circle from Cayman. It was about tax reform. And I am not a tax person. I'm a follow the money person, but usually I do financial market regulation, securities regulation, and white collar crime. I don't do that, but I write about it. And I'm branching out into tax. And it was quite an honor and quite a terror to be doing this. And I had given that talk and been completely flambéed and then went out to a dinner. And in the middle of the dinner, I happened to be seated next to someone who said incredibly Nazi-ish fascist things. He does not teach at the law school, but I later discussed with my host what had gone down, and he did a great job of explaining and saying this guy would not be invited back. So I had gotten up in the middle of the dinner and walked out. I said, I need to check on something, and I just didn't come back. And I met you guys somewhere else where you had already started dinner, and I really needed a drink, and I don't drink wine, and I really needed a martini. And so next door, they apparently had them, but then I had to take it away in a plastic to-go cup.
That was so cool.
And let me tell you, that is no way to drink a dirty vodka martini. It was terrible.
That was so cool.
Which, and we, and by the way, then I came home from New York with COVID. So I don't know. Did you get COVID at that time?
I got COVID, I think 2 weeks after that. You did not give me COVID.
But I want to ask you about that. Okay. Is it true that your publisher actually, you got locked in a hotel room?
I was stuck in a hotel in Manhattan. I was sick as a dog. I had to cancel some very cool book events that I'd been looking forward to. And Penguin Press and my team at Penguin sent me matzo ball chicken soup to my hotel.
That's incredible.
And I, because as you may recall in COVID, you're just in this like welter of like pain and feelings and you can't taste anything and you're so sad. I just like wept into the soup for 3 days and it sustained me. So yes, I was very, very lucky. But the funny, if we're just gonna just freestyle for a minute, I will say I had just come back from the once-in-a-lifetime experience of interviewing Margaret Atwood in Palo Alto, and I was heartsick that I had given 84-year-old Margaret Atwood COVID, in which case, all the chicken soup in the world was not going to fix that. I did not. Listener, I did not give her COVID.
Well, good for you.
Wait.
I mean, that would be...
Am I supposed to answer the question of how I met my husband?
Oh, my God. I already forgot about Aaron. I mean, yes. How did you meet Aaron?
Will you sing the theme song? I met Aaron very shortly after I moved to D.C. and started covering the court within a very, very compressed amount of time. My very close friend, Julie Hilden, who has tragically passed away since, invited me to a party in her fantastic apartment in New York and said, all these fancy journalists are going to be there. You should come. I came to the party. I was living in D.C. Aaron was the only not fancy journalist at the party. And here is where I disclose that I, instead of flirting with the very handsome man who was trying to flirt with me, I just left Reno, Nevada, where I'd been doing family law. I just tried to relitigate his divorce settlement for him. I was like, wait, let's talk about the China again. So I almost...
Wait, Aaron was divorced?
See, now you know things. Yes.
And what kind of China? Who cares about China?
I felt that he had not gotten an entirely fair settlement, and I thought it was incumbent on me. And let me be clear, listener, he's very cute.
Oh, God, this is so funny.
He's very, very cute. And he's just trying to, like, talk to me, and I'm like, so help me understand how the assets were allocated.
This is such a good story.
Yeah, it's a great story. I don't know if he loves this story, but it is true that I almost, like, blew it on our first meeting because not only that, but I had straightened my hair for that event, and so I didn't look like me or any of the people who would play me in the biopic. I just looked.
Okay, so this is what we're coming back to. I've given you plenty of time. Who's going to play you in the biopic?
Yeah.
Biopic or is it biopic?
I have always heard it as biopic, but...
Okay, I'll go with that if that's what you want.
I think you should have your team of fact checkers. The booked up fact checking team should jump on that.
The trouble is they're Brits, so they don't know how to pronounce anything. Just kidding. We don't.
Oh, who's playing me? I think it's some mashup of like Bette Midler... Barbara Streisand, Sarah Jessica Parker. Like, it's that amalgam of, like, all of those curly-headed women who kind of...
Amy Adams could do it, too, if they curlied her hair. No?
Maybe.
Sarah Jessica Parker. I think that could be.
Never going to happen. I'm on it. Okay, thank you.
Okay, that's good. Cool.
Have we resolved all of the dangling questions?
I mean, I have more questions for you, but I think we do. I know. Yeah. I mean, I guess what I would say is Kathy Griffin.
Mm-hmm.
I asked her, her to give me a question, and she wrote, "How do you sleep at night?" And I thought she meant you, but I realized it was for the justices. But I want to ask you, how do you sleep at night, Dahlia?
Okay, so this is where we just disclose that one of the reasons that I am your first guest on this phenomenal show is because you and I have a pact, right, that has gone back a couple of years, which is when one of us is like metaphorically puking or snapping or like things are just too hard, like the other one talks us down, right? And that's happened more than once. And I really distinctly remember it happening, like when I was in a hotel in DC trying to get out and cover a Supreme Court case that I could not cover.
And I told her you don't have to.
And you said, I don't have to. And you also like really, really reminded me there are limits to, you know, people who feel that their job is to hold this thing up all the time and never get tired. Like you can be tired. Do you remember that conversation?
I do remember. It was like 3 days before COVID hit and everything got, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, do you have any questions for me?
Let me finish what? The second half of that thing, which is I think I sleep at night because I have this like army of people who send soup to my hotel. Like I have just been so blessed with amazing poor husband who married me despite the relitigating his prior marriage. I have incredible kids, my parents, my family, my friends. And I think that one of the reasons I wrote the book and one of the reasons I'm happy to be with you on the show is because there are like extraordinary human beings moving through the world in a time of great pain and hardship who are putting democracy first and they lift me up. That's the answer.
I cannot, you know, I'm sorry, we're not going to end with this because it's just too sweet for me. I have to ask one last thing for you to tell us, which is why in the world did you wear Axe body spray for a week?
Okay, so we're just now going over the greatest and lesser
things. Then we're going to wrap it up after that, I promise.
This is highly contested in my family. My children do not believe this to be true. I believe it to be true, and I'm the writer, and I committed it to writing, so... they started using their cousin's Axe body spray on vacation, Axe shampoo and Axe. They were young, maybe 11, 13, and I hated it. And then I thought I wanted to see what it would be like to move through life smelling like a entitled, fabulous teenage boy that had Boom Chicka Wah Wah soundtrack playing in the background. And so I wore it for a week. And amazing things happen. You may have to, in your show notes, just link to the piece. But I have never had a better time in my life than I had smelling like a 14-year-old boy for a week. And fun coda, the good people at Axe were so happy with the unsolicited, unpaid-for free publicity that they sent me a box, no word of a lie, 4 feet tall, full of Axe products to thank me. And we were using Axe in my household for years to follow.
And with that, I'd like to thank our sponsor, Axe Body
Spray. Okay, kiddo.
Love you.
Love you,
thank
too.
You so much.
Congrats.
Oof, that was amazing, and I have a long list of questions I didn't get a chance to ask Dahlia. She had to dash off to host her own podcast. So I'm curious whether there were things that you also wanted to know that we didn't get to. If so, please email me at bookedup@politicon.com or send a postcard or letter to Booked Up, P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01060. And see you next week.